Current Affairs. Good evening, listeners. Welcome to today's Current Affairs. My name is Tina Jha. Today, we will be discussing about the evolving dynamics of the West Asian conflict. To discuss this, we have with us Ambassador Ashok Sajjanhar, former diplomat, and Mr. Atul Aneja, strategic affairs analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on the program today. Ambassador, let me begin the program with you. So has the killing of Ali Larijani, all of us know he was a central figure in shaping Iran's strategic decisions, has his killing further escalated the war? And is the world now looking at a conflict which is moving beyond deterrence into a, say, far more dangerous phase, given the kind of stronger retaliation coming from Iran?
Yes, thank you very much, Tina, for having me on the show. And it's always a pleasure to be on Akashvani. You're very right. I think Ali Larijani, of course, he was a very prominent figure. As far as Iran is concerned, he was really the one who was directing the response as far as the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran are concerned. But he was also seen to be a figure with whom possibly, if any negotiations that to be undertaken, then he could have been a figure, he had that sort of clout, he had that sort of control as far as Iran is concerned, where whatever he said, it would be given due considerations and it would be taken on board. But even he is gone, and it was even thought that there was some sort of discussion, some sort of negotiations from some of the moderates on the side of Israel and the United States, who were having some back channel discussions with him or with his advisors. And with him also gone out of the field, you know, it becomes very tenuous as to if you have to have a discussion. Because after all, as you said very correctly, this is today is the end of the third week. Tomorrow we'll start the fourth week, because this all started on a Saturday on the 28th. So tomorrow will be the start of the fourth week. And what we had hoped that it would be over in about a week or 10 days, that is what President Trump had said right at the beginning. Rather than that happening, the scope and the geographical coverage of this conflict has been expanding. And there have been, and as you said very correctly again, it is having an impact not only on the three countries that were initially involved, that is Iran, Israel, and the United States, but it has covered the whole Gulf, because there have been attacks against all these countries in the Gulf, GCC, but even beyond that, even Turkey has been attacked, even Cyprus has been attacked, even Azerbaijan has been attacked. Azerbaijan has no bases of the United States, but even that has been attacked. So we have seen that in geographical coverage it has increased. And of course, as far as the economic impact is concerned, that has been huge, because we have seen after the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, no energy can come out of that. It was the Strait was responsible for feeding about 20% of the global oil requirements, energy requirements, and about 30 to 40% of the gas requirements of the LPG that was coming out to meet the requirements of the world. And I'm sure you will come to what does it all mean for India. But for India also, it is a very difficult time. And that is why we have been asking, Prime Minister has been speaking to each and every leader of the region and beyond, and asking that there should be de-escalation happening. But with the killing of Larijani, that is what we started, that seems to have moved a step backwards.
Certainly. We will talk about some of the implications and, most importantly, the economic downturn that the world at the moment is staring at because of the prolonged conflict. But Mr. Aneja, in your view, since now we are entering a fourth week of the conflict, do you think it's already crossed a threshold where containment is getting difficult by the day, the manner in which Iran is retaliating, the manner in which the conflict is expanding to countries that were not even involved initially?
Tina, I think it's really expanding. It's not escalating, let me put it that way. And I think that escalation began, there were two things. One is the attack on the South Pars gas field of Iran. I think that was a pivotal moment, because when you are attacking energy resources of a country, that sets up a different spiral, because the counter attacks are also coming on energy resources. And these damages can be huge and very, very long term. So we have had, after the attack on the South Pars field, Iranians attacking the Ras Laffan refinery and the entire project. It's a massive, it's linked to the North Dome gas field, which is actually an extension of the South Pars in a way. And along with that, there have also been attacks in Kuwait. There have been attacks in Saudi Arabia. So as a result, the energy infrastructure is being hit. And that's a big sort of a escalation which has taken place, because this is long term. This is not attack on other targets which can be rebuilt easily. So I think that spiral, its escalation has started. I would like to really mention a little bit about Larijani. You see, Larijani comes from a generation of people who cut their teeth in the Iran-Iraq war, which took place between 1980 and 88. And even Khamenei came out from that. What we are finding is that this is a generation of mature, seasoned people who are good negotiators, as Sajjan Har was saying, that these are people you can talk to, who are seasoned diplomats, who have had array of responsibilities. Larijani himself was a speaker of the Majlis at one time before, and he was not, he moved into the inner circle of Ayatollah Khamenei. So you have Ayatollah Khamenei being killed, you have Larijani being killed, and you look at people like Araghchi, for example, the foreign minister. I mean, these are the kind of people you can talk to. But when you start targeting them, you are getting a new hardline leadership which is replacing them. It is mostly coming from the IRGC, from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who will be uncompromising. So as a result, this sort of docks into whether we are going to have a negotiated settlement any soon. To have a negotiated settlement, you need negotiators. But if you're killing off the negotiators, that itself is dampening the prospects of any kind of a meaningful long-term diplomatic initiative.
That's right.
Which means we are back to the original point, that the escalation is going on, and now you have the danger of boots on the ground. We're moving into that domain because 8,000 troops, Marines, are on their way to the Gulf.
Like both of you have explained to us, that the manner in which it's expanded to the neighborhood, now we are seeing 3 weeks of attacks by Iran onto these countries. Now their energy infrastructure is being targeted. We have seen strong reactions now coming in from countries like Saudi Arabia, from Qatar. The fact that perhaps their patience is also waning out. And do you see the circumstances building up to a wider conflict in the region, which could see more and more parties getting involved in the days to come?
You're very right, Tina, when you say that, you know, their patience is also wearing thin. And this is what many had expected. First of all, I think it came as a surprise to these countries, definitely, and to the whole world also. Because over the last 47 years, whenever there have been conflicts, you know, ever since the Islamic Republic was established, whenever there have been conflicts, Iran never hit out at the Gulf states, although the relations were all never too good. Meaning they had started improving only in recent years. And there was exchange of foreign ministers, there was exchange of senior leaders between whether it was Saudi Arabia and Iran, United Arab Emirates and Iran, Qatar and Iran, of course, when Qatar was put under, you know, an embargo by the Gulf countries a few years ago, then its lifeline, in fact, was Iran. And so also Oman has been the mediator. So relations had been getting more stable and more normal, let me put it this way. So Iran had never really hit out at those countries. Now, it was known that Iran is going to hit out at the bases of America in these countries. And America has bases in all these countries. And let us be quite clear about it, that these bases are not meant to act as bulwark against any other country except Iran. Because these countries felt threatened by Iran, particularly after the Islamic Revolution that took place in 1979, and also because of the terrorist proxies that Iran had organized, whether it was the Houthis in Yemen, whether it was Hamas in Gaza, whether it was Hezbollah in Lebanon, etc., in Syria, in Iraq, etc. So it was basically to protect them against Iran that all these bases had been got established by the United States. So Iran had never attacked them. Iran had, again, you know, we need to realize that it had been on the back foot many a times. Even last year in June, the 12-day war, there were all these B-2 bombers that had come and that had, you know, bunker buster bombs that had been offloaded on them. But still, it never shut the Strait of Hormuz. So I think there were all these miscalculations, in my view, on the part of the United States, that number one, Iran will be able to fight back in the manner that it has. It will strike at the Gulf states, not only at the American bases, but even at the civilian infrastructure, facilities, airports, hotels, the pipelines, the refineries, and then it has been expanding this. So looking at it right now, what it appears is that I think Mr. Netanyahu has also said that they are not going to hit out at the other energy installations and facilities of Iran. We'll really have to wait and see whether Iran also stops its attacks on all these places, because it has gone out in a very big way, number one. Number two, I think the damage that has been inflicted on these refineries and on this energy infrastructure, it is not going to be completed, it is not going to be made up within a few months.
Absolutely.
Or a
it's
few years.
It's going to reverberate across the world.
It's going to take a long time. So that is going to create problems as far as the global economy is concerned, global energy supplies are concerned. And if, you know what the United States has said, that we are going to unsanction, we are going to de-sanction the Iranian oil on the high seas, what does it mean that all these high prices of oil are going to accrue to Iran? Exactly the country that you wanted to punish, now you are, it's going to benefit.
In fact, both countries, not just Iran, even Russia. I mean, even the Russia-Ukraine war started, Anija, the sanctions were on Russia, and India was put to question on why we were purchasing energy and oil and petroleum products from Russia, in a way accusing India of funding the Russia-Ukraine war. But now the very same country we're seeing, it's when you de-sanction Iran, and in order to stabilize the energy markets, it's exactly benefiting the two countries that Americans wanted to punish.
This is interesting, because I think we need to appreciate the energy angle in a broader perspective. Mm. If you recall 2003 war on Iraq, essentially it was not that the Americans wanted Saddam's oil, but the idea was to control oil and use that as lever in your foreign policy to promote your foreign policy interests. I think that we have to look at Iran and connect it with what happened with Venezuela. Because once Venezuela happened and Maduro was gone, you got hold of the Venezuelan oil as leverage. Who was buying Venezuelan oil? It was the Chinese who were getting the Venezuelan oil to the maximum. And now you look at Iran, another oil-rich country. If you can control Iranian oil, combine it with control over the Venezuelan oil, the leverage you have is enormous over countries over the horizon. And I would say that the Chinese would be the one who would be the next who would feel the pinch in case there is regime change and the Americans are able to control it. And that is the energy is coming in as the major factor. If you look at what Trump is saying, he's talking about opening Hormuz, he's calling the Europeans to open and join the Americans to do it. Because oil, I think this is, even World War II was about oil, if you read. So it's a question of control of oil. I think this is big. And if you control oil, then you go into the next level, which is unipolarity 2.0. Because if you can have these levers over the Russians and over the Chinese, then all this attempt at multipolarity, and it gets all, is smashed.
Even what you're saying,
so
Ambassador,
the objectives are much larger.
In fact, that's the question that I want to bring in, Ambassador, into. Given the divergences in statements made by Israel and Americans, especially with regard to the attack on the Iranian oil field, based on what Mr. Aneja also said, do you think the objective among the two countries that led the preemptive strike on Iran are completely different? So what Israel wants out of this war and what Americans want are completely two different things.
Okay, let me put it this way. I think as far as the Americans are concerned, they have been changing their objectives and they have been changing their goalposts. We have heard so many times, Mr. Trump first came in with a regime change. Then he said we want to cap the nuclear capabilities of Iran. Then they said as far as the missile arsenal is concerned, their manufacturing capabilities and all the stockpiles that they have, we want to destroy them. Then he said, all these terrorist proxies, which they call the axis of resistance, Houthi, Hezbollah, Hamas, etc., we want to destroy that. So, it's been changing. And you heard, I think everyone really heard also what Marco Rubio said, that he said that we knew that Israel was going to hit Iran. And so that is why, and then Iran would have hit us. So we went in there. They said it was a preemptive strike. But even the DIA, Tulsi Gabbard, has said that, number one, as far as any imminence of Iran going in for nuclear weapons, that did not exist. And also, we were not removing any preemptive threat or danger that was there. Israel has been very, very clear. It has been waiting for this opportunity, in my view, since the last 35, 40 years. How to get the United States and, you know, both Israel and America coming together to attack Iran. Because that is how they can obliterate. Because as far as Israel is concerned, it faces an existential threat. Because it is the leaders and umpteen number of leaders, whether it is Khamenei or it is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was the president earlier, who said Israel has to be removed off the map of this world. So it has that existential threat. Also, if it were ever to become a nuclear weapon power state, they would have a huge threat from Iran. So it has been waiting for this opportunity. And if, as an aside, I could also say, it has also been its objective that all the Gulf states should come together with the United States and with Israel against Iran.
But the question is, have they come together, Mr. Aneja? Because now we are seeing the manner in which damage has inflicted upon all of these Gulf countries by Iran, unprovoked, the manner in which now they are responding, and there is difference in their responses as well. How do you assess the statement, especially coming in from Qatar, that they do know who are the real ones who are gaining out of this war? So once this conflict ends, do you see newer alliances, newer dimensions emerging from the Gulf region?
Interesting question, Dina. It will change as the war goes on. Right now, I think it will lead to a greater consolidation of most of the Gulf countries with the Americans. Because if these countries realize that the Americans and the Israelis are going to be the winners in this, then might as well get closer with your trusted allies. You know, you even go stronger with them. That's scenario one. Scenario two, if this prolongs and you suddenly see oil prices hitting $180, $200, already there are internal dissensions within the American camp. Joe Kent has resigned. Tulsi Gabbard was neither here nor there yesterday. Then Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance going in different direction, midterm polls coming in. A lot of that dynamic will depend on what happens inside Iran. In case there is an attack by Marines and their body bags going back, it'll play merry hell domestically. So it depends on the time horizons. If the Gulf countries realize after a while, and this is purely hypothetical, I'm just building a scenario, that Iran is quote-unquote winning, becoming the stronger country out of this, the most important given its resources, and if it is de-sanctioned by rising power again in the region, then I think we will see the cracks widening within the GCC countries. You know, yesterday's statement which you talked about, early days, the Qatari Prime Minister has flagged something where the target is more towards Israel rather than Iran. So it's the beginning of the process. I would say that even now, there would be some back channel between some of the GCC countries, because not all are uniform. I don't expect Saudis and the Iranians having it, but maybe Qatari, Turk, Iran. This has been there for some time, this triangulation. So it would start now, but still early days to see where exactly will the fault lines go, if at all.
So this was about the region. If we speak outside the region, we've seen how the American president has sought help from partner countries in Europe. But I mean, a lot of these countries have turned down the request in getting involved in the conflict directly. Do you also see divergences emerging out of this war in Iran within America's partnerships, especially security partnerships with some of these countries?
These divergences had already started coming in because you would recall, even as far as NATO is concerned, President Trump in his first term had said that NATO is brain dead. And, you know, he had been sort of, you know, pressurizing all the NATO countries. And he was successful. First, he was saying 2% of the GDP should go in for the defense, then 3% that they should take on the responsibility. And then most recently in the NATO summit, 5%. So, and the transatlantic partnership, for a variety of reasons, you know, for what he said about Canada, about the US, Canada, Mexico trade agreement, tariffs, the dilution of the transatlantic partnership on Greenland, etc. There were so many things. So, you know, that was definitely coming down. But what whether it is the European NATO allies that have said, or the other countries like Japan and South Korea and Australia, who had also been requested for support and assistance in, you know, providing security as far as and opening up the Strait of Hormuz is concerned. I think the NATO countries have said very categorically that we are supposed to be a defensive organization, a defensive partnership. And it is not a NATO's war. It is, you know, they, without possibly saying it in so many words, they have said it's a war of choice as far as the United States and Israel is concerned. And many countries also in private conversations have seemed to suggest that it is Israel who has sort of, you know, strung along the United States as far as attacking Israel, Iran is concerned.
Let me now, Ambassador, bring India into the picture as well. Time is running out, and India is an important player, not just because we have significant stakes. We have a large number of diaspora, so we are concerned about their safety and security, but also because of our energy interests that lie in the region. How do you assess the manner in which India has responded, the manner in which our Prime Minister is reaching out to each leader within the GCC, but also outside, leaders who can make an impact, leaders who can perhaps bring an end to this hostility?
You know, what our stance has been that, you know, we should try to de-escalate. We should try to have dialogue and diplomacy. War is not a solution, doesn't provide solution to any issue whatsoever. And that is why he's trying to build up a wider coalition. He has been, you know, we even co-sponsored the resolution at the UN General Assembly in which Iran was criticized for launching these attacks against these countries in the Gulf, because that very significantly impacts upon us as far as India is concerned. And what are India's objectives? Basically, to keep moving towards Viksit Bharat 2047. We need to have, you know, all the energy that we require as far as getting our economy by 7-8% GDP growth every year, so that we are able to have $10 trillion GDP by 2035 and we have a $30 trillion by 2047. And that will get scuppered if, you know, energy prices increase. That is why Prime Minister has been speaking. He's spoken, I think, to the President of the UAE more than once, to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and to the Emir of Qatar and all the others, even to the President of France, even to the Prime Minister of Malaysia yesterday, basically trying to develop a coalition so that pressure can be put on both sides that this we need to get de-escalation as far as this conflict is concerned.
The question is, when we talk of de-escalation, when we talk of peace, Mr. Aneja, who plays the mediator? And we've seen that in this case, even when the mediation was almost in the final stages, the preemptive strike took place. And now you have a regime in Iran, in the manner in which the war started, and we've seen the entire tier of leadership being eliminated. So now you've already explained how we have a hardline layer of leadership. It will be difficult to negotiate with them, number one, because of their approach, but number two, also because it's been a setback for the negotiation was at its final stages and then the war went ahead. The bigger question will be who mediates now? At a point when it's spiraling beyond containment and it's impacting the whole world, who mediates is the bigger question.
India is very well positioned to play a very active diplomatic role because, as Ambassador Sajjanar said, that it is in our interest, deep interest, people, energy, historical relations with the region, civilizational ties. There are a lot of reasons why we need to get this over with. India is well positioned for a reason. We have good relations on all sides. Very few countries have it. We talk to the Israelis, we talk to the Iranians, we talk to the Gulf countries, we talk to the Americans, and we can talk to the Russians. India, I think, is very well positioned. The Prime Minister has given a signal, I think, he by talking, by engaging directly with some of these leaders. But I think a major, major follow-up needs to be done. Why it's a whole-of-government approach, we need the External Affairs Ministry to really get into this act on the direction of the Prime Minister and make a real difference, because this is too serious for us. We have 9 million. No, neither the Chinese have this problem nor the Russians have this problem. 90 lakh people, imagine tomorrow we have to evacuate them. In my view, it will be, in a warlike situation, virtually impossible. So we got to have prevent this war from escalating to a level when we have to do these evacuations. Energy flows, food security, gas comes from there for fertilizer use. The stakes are extremely high for India, and I think the Prime Minister has set the ball rolling. Major follow-ups required to play a role. You asked who to mediate. This is also a time, Tina. We are the chair of the BRICS at this time. We have the capacity now to talk to all the BRICS members, and this is not the old BRICS, this is BRICS Plus. You have the UAE also here, you have the Egyptians over there, you have Ethiopians over there. The outreach to Global South can come through BRICS. So I think we are well positioned. Prime Minister has started, but much more, in my view, needs to be done because it's just too serious for us.
From a diplomatic perspective then, Ambassador, how do we minimize the divergences? Within BRICS, we have differing voices. It's an opportunity for India, not because there is so much at interest, but also because we stand on the side of peace. We've always advocated dialogue and diplomacy, and we want cessation of hostilities. When it's a matter as serious as this one, what kind of diplomatic efforts will be required now to follow up on the Prime Minister's calls to so many of the leaders within the Gulf region and worldwide?
India's voice is listened to with attention and with respect because I think most of the countries feel that can be unbiased. We are not taking sides, and we can go in the sensible middle, if I may call it that way. Prime Minister has also, in addition to speaking all the Gulf leaders, he has also spoken to the President of Iran. We have been able to extricate 2-3 of our ships from there so that, you know, that takes the pressure off, immediate pressure at least, of the supply of LPG to our people. India's voice is and India's position. And we have experience behind us, Tina, because we saw in G20 how the world was fractured on the question of Ukraine. But still, we were able to get the whole world together. And even on the first day, you know, people said that it was absolutely impossible to get a consensus declaration. And here at the beginning, on the first day itself, the Prime Minister announced that we've been able to get full agreement on the leaders' declaration. So I think India has that standing, India has that reputation, India has that image, India has that experience. And so India can definitely collect a group of countries who are also listened to with respect. And I think it is for that reason that the Prime Minister has moved out of that region, you know, to go to France, to go to Malaysia, to go to some of the others who are not directly involved, you know, countries which are not directly involved in this conflict. And like France has also said that, you know, we are not going to engage. Once there is a ceasefire, we'll come for the security of the Hormuz, but not before that. So I think there are countries like that who can play a role along with India, but India has to sort of, you know, get all of them together and take this lead the pack.
I'm sure while the efforts are underway to make sure that at least, you know, a temporary ceasefire is announced and that the warring parties at least come to the negotiating table, the immediate priority is to secure our energy needs. Our appetite for energy is immense given the population, Mr. Aneja. How are we leveraging the advantage of multi-alignment to secure our energy needs?
I think the most important here is our relationship with Russia. That becomes top priority. Already, I think before I came here, I just saw this news that about 4 to 5 ships of crude from Russia, which are bound for China, have been diverted to India. We have this special privileged relationship, strategic partnership with Russia. I think the time to test it out is now. So that will be a very important axis to work on, because the route of energy from Russia is from the Russian Far East, and then it comes along the Pacific to the Bay of Bengal and towards India. So it doesn't get into the war zone at all. So that is number one. I think Africa, you need to diversify and see how we can get our energy sources from there. While we already are, it's heartening to see the Prime Minister talk to the Iranian President, Mr. Pezeshkian, and the External Affairs Minister has been regularly talking to his counterpart, Mr. Araghchi. I think to get Indian ships out, and that is also happened. Before I came, I saw 2 more ships from the Hormuz coming to India. So we have to also leverage our very special relationship with Iran, to be honest, to get advantages or to get our ships out, because energy security in LPG, it's vital interest. So I think we need to move on 2-3 axes as far as energy is concerned. But once again, I think Russia would be critical.
Yeah, I just want to add one more point, and that is that, you know, over the last few years, India has started diversifying its imports of energy, oil, etc. And today, while earlier there were about 20 countries from which we were importing our crude requirements, today there are more than 40 countries. So I think our basket is quite diversified. Secondly, we see that, you know, our import of gas, LPG for instance, 47% of our LPG requirement comes from Qatar and about 90% of our LPG requirement comes from the Gulf area. So while we are diversifying, Gulf area continues to be very significant for us. And as you said very correctly, the multi-alignment policy that we are following, I think that is yielding us good dividends and that needs to be continued forward.
Absolutely. So with that hope that war comes to an end, because it's not just expanding and impacting within the region, it's impacting all of us in the distant places as well. I mean, we're not that distant, but I'm sure the impact, the economic impact is being faced by people across the world. And we hope that it comes to an end as soon as possible. Thank you so much, Ambassador and Mr. Aneja.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can also hear this program on our mobile app, News on AIR, and also our YouTube channel, News on AIR Official.
Current Affairs.